KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
I live in Richmond.
Lake Merritt.
Coming up, we're exploring what it means to protest during the national anthem.
Kaepernick brought an issue to the public that apparently is as old as the cotton fields.
Former San Francisco 49ers quarterback Colin Kaepernick sparked a controversy around the country when he spoke out against police bias during a flag ceremony.
I said from the beginning I was against the system of oppression.
Colin, if this country disgusts you so much, leave.
We'll explore the meaning of the national anthem, the history behind Kaepernick's action, and the reverberations around the Bay Area.
The reason we kneel is because we're not one people right now, we're just two separate sides.
The original KALW News documentary, Kaepernick, coming up on Cross Currents. For many people, this is a time to reflect on what it means to live in the United States. The election of President Donald Trump revealed a divided nation. Recent events have many folks saying they feel like strangers in their own country. Clearly, many already did. One person who's become an iconic example of the division is Colin Kaepernick, the former quarterback of the San Francisco 49ers. Before a preseason game last season, he launched a movement by choosing not to stand during the singing of the national anthem. He said it was a protest against police brutalizing people of color in the United States.
I mean, ultimately, it's to bring awareness and make people realize what's really going on in this country. There are a lot of things that are going on that are unjust, people aren't being held accountable for, and that's something that needs to change. That's something that, this country stands for freedom, liberty, justice for all, and it's not happening for all right now.
His protest started a conversation across the country about what it means to respect the national anthem, and that's what we're taking on today. Colin Kaepernick no longer plays for the San Francisco 49ers. In fact, he doesn't play pro football at all. He's a free agent. And even though he was once considered one of the best quarterbacks in the game and is currently at his prime at 29 years old, no NFL team has picked him up. Some say it's a conspiracy that league owners are afraid of the backlash their fans may pay to the league in a time of divisive politics. But Kaepernick's legacy continues. Over the weekend, nearly two dozen NFL players reportedly demonstrated during the national anthem at games. And even though he currently plays for no team, Kaepernick was named Community MVP of the Week last week by the NFL Players Association, the union that represents athletes. They honored him for his continuing public service as he's donated nearly $1 million in the last year to social justice causes. Kaepernick has embraced his role as a spokesman. He's held three Know Your Rights camps for underprivileged kids across the country. They're inspired in part by the Black Panther Party. Kaepernick's first camp took place last year in Oakland, where more than 100 people learned about education, finances, physical fitness, and how to face oppression.
From top to bottom, it was something myself, my woman, our friends, we came together, we put it together as far as curriculum, the event, everything. So, we wanted to make sure it was something that was very grassroots, that was true to what we believed, and the message wasn't, skewed or misrepresented or manipulated by a corporation that we had to stand behind.
But then there's this. Kaepernick chose not to vote in the presidential election. In fact, it turns out he wasn't even registered to vote. That prompted a backlash from previous supporters, like commentator Stephen A. Smith on ESPN's First Take.
He absolutely betrayed his cause. As far as I'm concerned, Colin Kaepernick is absolutely irrelevant. I don't want to see him again. I don't want to hear from him again. I don't want to hear a damn word about anything that he has to say about our nation, the issues that we have, racial injustices, needing change, etc., etc. He comes across as a flaming hypocrite.
Kaepernick's abstention even prompted a joke from comedian Dave Chappelle during his opening monologue for NBC's Saturday Night Live.
So I'm staying out of it. Just gonna take a knee like Kaepernick and let the whites figure this out amongst themselves.
After the election, Kaepernick was asked about not voting.
I think it would be hypocritical for me to vote. I said from the beginning I was against oppression, I was against the system of oppression.
I'm not going to show support for that system. And to me, the oppressor isn't going to allow you to vote your way out of your oppression.
Kaepernick has invoked Malcolm X many times over the last few months. And Malcolm X's philosophies were complicated. You can hear that in one of the speeches he's best known for, made in 1964. It's called The Ballot or the Bullet. Malcolm X thought the Republican candidate for president, Barry Goldwater, was racist. He called him a wolf, an obvious threat. But Malcolm X was also frustrated with the policies of the Democratic Party under President Lyndon Johnson. He called Johnson a fox, a sneaky enemy. Whether by the fox or the wolf, Malcolm X said, black people would get eaten.
You can see that the Negro vote is the key factor. And despite the fact that you are in a position to be the determining factor, what do you get out of it? The Democrats have been in Washington, D.C. only because of the Negro vote. They've been down there 4 years. And all other legislation they wanted to bring up, they brought it up and gotten it out of the way, and now they bring up you. And now they bring up you. You put them first and they put you last. Because you're a chump.
Still, Malcolm X said it was important to be involved politically.
We must understand the politics of our community, and we must know what politics is supposed to produce. We must know what part politics play in our lives. And until we become politically mature, we will always be misled, led astray, or deceived or maneuvered into supporting someone politically who doesn't have the good of our community at heart.
Ultimately, he thought if there was no candidate he believed in, he would not vote. He said, quote, a ballot is like a bullet. You don't throw your ballots until you see a target. And if that target is not within your reach, keep your ballot in your pocket.
Today, our people can see that we're faced with a government conspiracy. This government has failed us.
Those are the words of Malcolm X speaking in Detroit, Michigan during a presidential campaign just over half a century ago. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Colin Kaepernick ignited a heated conversation over race and patriotism with a simple gesture involving the national anthem. We're all familiar with the song. It's played at the beginning of major sporting events in the United States. Francis Scott Key wrote the lyrics during the War of 1812. After the British Army burned down the White House and Congress, they tried but failed to destroy Fort McHenry in Baltimore. Key witnessed the assault and was inspired to record his thoughts in poetry. His words were set to a drinking song, and then, more than a century later, they were declared our national anthem. The part that we always hear is the first verse. We almost never hear the rest of the poem written by Key, who was a slave owner. Some of those words are, quote, no refuge could save the hireling and slave from the terror of flight or the gloom of the grave. On the surface, those lyrics appear to be about hunting down runaway slaves. But given the context of the time and place the poem was written, many historians say they more likely refer to the way the British Army used mercenaries and slaves to fight against the United States. But there's something else. The anthem wasn't finished. In 1861, another verse was added by Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., a writer, educator, and father of an eventual Supreme Court justice. I By the millions unchained who their birthright has gained, we will keep her bright blazon forever unstained. In his update to the national anthem at the onset of the Civil War, Wendell Holmes said that the flag stands for freeing the slaves. Like a holy book, the meaning of the words has changed over time. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Once Colin Kaepernick's protests of the national anthem were publicized, others began to demonstrate as well. Professional football players, other pro athletes, and high school students.
Are you ready for it?
A few weeks after Kaepernick's initial protest, football players from Mission High School in San Francisco were headed to a game in Redwood City. They were led by San Francisco Chronicle Player of the Year, Nyame Harris, a 17-year-old senior quarterback from Bayview.
We was talking about it on the bus with each other, and we was talking about what Kaepernick did a couple games before. And right before the national anthem came on, we were coming back from the coin toss. And we tell everybody to take a knee, and we're going to take a knee for the rights of the United States. And when I took a knee and everyone else took a knee, I felt that I was a big leader and I felt like I was doing something right.
Everybody followed his lead, except one player. Kicker Duncan Lau stood behind his teammates as they knelt during the national anthem, and he held his fist in the air. He respected the protest of his football family, but he also wanted to honor his grandfather.
He was a colonel in World War II, and I mean, he risked his life for the anthem and for the flag, and he lost plenty of friends and family to it too, as well. It's not supposed to be disrespectful towards anybody, but it's supposed to be more supportive and constructive towards both sides. I mean, that's why I raised the fist as well, just to show that I was both sides of my family.
The impromptu demonstration took head coach Greg Hill by surprise. He says he supported his team, but he himself stayed standing.
I have uncles who have Purple Hearts in the military from when they were in the armed forces, so I'm supporting my team and what they do, and at the same time, I stand out of respect.
The team's protest drew national media attention. Kicker Duncan Lau says he and his teammates received praise and criticism.
There's a lot of racist comments, sexist comments. There's a lot of using hateful words and that I'm not going to say on the press, but It's just a lot of hate that we shouldn't see in our country because we're supposed to be one people. But the reason we kneel is because we're not one people right now. We're just two separate sides.
The action brought the team together. They went on to sweep all of the regular season games. Star athlete Nyame Harris ultimately led Mission High's basketball team to the first state championship for any basketball team in the history of the San Francisco Unified School District. Over in East Oakland, Ed Washington is the head football coach of another school, Castlemont High. He got a call one day from Kaepernick's manager. The NFL quarterback heard that the players had held their own protest, laying down during the national anthem, and he wanted to meet with them. So he did. You can hear him talking with the students in this cell phone video.
I see your courage, your confidence, and that's something that you have to be able to speak into each other as well. When you talk to him, talk to him with confidence. Speak confidence into him. You're going to play great today. You're going to be the best player out there. And not just the best player on the field, you're going to be the best player when you walk off that field and into the real world.
Coach Washington says the students were
stunned. They were stunned, man. They were stunned and they were excited and they were happy.
I had to come support y'all because the same way y'all took a stand and stood with me, I had to come out here and stand with y'all. So I appreciate what y'all did. I love y'all. Y'all my brothers. I'm here with you.
Kaepernick's contact with the team didn't end with that visit. Coach Washington.
Kaepernick, and this is just between us. I mean, I put it out there. Kaepernick buys us pregame meals every week. And he buys post-game meals just to get these kids fed and to help me out because he really appreciate what we're doing. He invited us down to the little function he threw downtown. And, man, it's just a beautiful thing, man. When he said he was our brother, he was their brother, he meant that. And he meant that because he's showing that. We got people from Oakland won't even come over here to our school. And we in probably the roughest part of Oakland. And none of people won't even show up. You know what I'm saying? That's, you know, on a got that platform. So for him to do that and take a stand, that was real big and that was powerful.
Thanks to KALW's Bowen Wang for that recording. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. It's not only football players protesting the national anthem. Members of the Oakland Unified School District Honors Band also discussed ways to take part. The band is made up of middle and high school students, with a performance at the Oakland Coliseum coming up about a month after Kaepernick's first protests. They considered their role in the conversation about racial discrimination and patriotism. One of the 150 students approached music teacher Ted Allen.
We had one student who said that they weren't going to do the event for political reasons. They didn't want to play the national anthem at all or participate. And so then I realized we had an issue that we had to deal with.
We talked about the lyrics. We talked about, you know, the fifth verse that talks about slavery. We talked about symbolism of the flag and can one have conflicting feelings about one's country and still show patriotism by performing or standing or kneeling.
We discuss it in classes, not just our jazz band, but throughout other classes at our school. And before we played, we were also notified by the band director.
Our teacher told us that if we wanted to, we could kneel out of solidarity.
To respond to Kaepernick and also support him in his endeavors in fighting systemic racism.
As we were warming up and we knew that this was going to go down at the event and there were parents around at the warm-up who dropped their children off and were watching how things were going. They were excited and were very supportive of the idea. So it wasn't just the teachers, it wasn't just the students, it's coming out of the entire community.
I walked into the field and felt proud of myself for something that I was doing good and right. And I just felt inspired by other people clapping and cheering for us that was just there to watch us and the Ace game, and it felt inspiring.
Well, when they came up with the idea of us taking a kneel, I kind of felt like, as an African American, that I should, knowing that that could be anyone in my family, you know, dying because of police brutality.
You know, standing there and watching this and being part of it, I was actually tearing up watching these kids express themselves.
As we played Land of the Free, those who wanted to kneel down, the crowd applauded, and we finished the end of the song like that. I chose to kneel.
It was a moment to be involved.
So the next day after I kneeled, my mom told me, like, she interrogated me kind of. She's like, why did you kneel? And, like, she's like, it doesn't really affect you. I don't know why you did it. And I was like, well, I mean, we all have to stand up for someone, right? Like, if we don't do it, then who's going to do it?
A lot of people thought that we were dishonoring our country by kneeling and, like, not being part of it.
With some of my friends, we were looking on YouTube about it, and we found some news channels which... some of it was negative, a lot of it was negative actually, and only a little bit was positive, and a lot of it entailed the video, the title saying, Oakland Unified Honor Band shames themselves.
Well, Oakland High School has now disgraced themselves during the national anthem at a recent A's game. Black high school and middle school children in the Oakland Unified School District's Honor Band took a knee during the national anthem at the Oakland A's game this week.
A lot of those comments on Facebook and other websites were that we don't really know what's happening in the world and we can't understand. But really, I think it's the exact opposite. We're trying to make our country a better place.
A better place so people can feel comfortable where they stand and with their differences.
I was just thinking about how everybody always says, especially like during the elections and things, how kids are the future. And so I was thinking about how for the future, we could make a difference starting now.
If we just stand up for ourselves and no one else, then there's going to be no one else to stand up for us.
It shows that the Oakland kids are aware of what's happening, and we just, they're not afraid to express their opinions. And I mean, I think it was a good message to Oakland.
Because it wasn't a small thing to do. Either, whichever way people chose to act, kneeling or not kneeling, it took a lot of personal reflection. And talking before and after has just made me feel more like I know what my values are and I know what I'm willing to stand up for.
That piece was produced by KALW's Jeremy Jew. It includes the voices of Ted Allen, Daisy Amador, Emily Anzora, Quinn Flannery, Cesar Hernandez, Helena Jack, Tarashi Lee, Charlie Martindale, Daniel Martinez, Serena McIntosh, Olivia Modi, Ayodine Oludayu, Carson Paul, and Zach Pitt-Smith from Oakland Technical High School and Edna Brewer Middle School. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. The national anthem protests also affected another group of people, inmates at San Quentin State Prison. For some of their thoughts, we turn to San Quentin Radio.
San Quentin Radio, bringing you informative educational stories from the inside out.
In order to make something grow, you got to own a little dirt.
You don't tell, you see what goes on.
Because I like to be free. I like to move about the land.
You could hear a pin drop, and all of a sudden, you heard this.
More than two-thirds of inmates in California state prisons are Latino or African American, according to the most recent census. More than 1,000 military veterans are incarcerated annually, and all of them have dealt with police officers. San Quentin radio reporter Lewis A. Scott talked to a number of inmates to get a sense for what they think about protesting during the national anthem.
My name is Charles David Henry. I'm in prison for an attempted murder on a Long Beach police officer. I've been in prison for 12 years. I was in the United States Air Force Security Service for 3 years, 11 months, and 13 days.
My name is Emil DeWeaver. When I was 18 years old, I murdered a man and I attempted to murder a witness. I've been in prison for the past 20 years.
My name is Gary Cooper. I served in the Marine Corps from 1966 to 70, a combat veteran, Vietnam 66 to 68.
My name is Angelo Mecchi. I've been in prison for 21 years. I committed the offense of residential burglary.
Brian Shipp. I've been in prison now for 36 years on a first term of kidnap for robbery.
My name is Craig Johnson, 60 years old. I've been incarcerated for 37 years. For second-degree murder. I'm a veteran of the United States Navy, serving from 1973 to 1979.
Kaepernick brought an issue to the public that apparently is as old as the cotton fields. People need to be aware of the fact that things haven't changed since the existence of the Constitution. Black men, black women, black families, inner cities are still deprived. And unfortunately, America has not addressed the issue.
My experience with the police, where they were the person who pulled my father over, who was a doctor, and they treated him like a drug dealer. And he would get back in the car, and he'd be very humiliated, and he'd be very angry. And sometimes he would talk about how it felt to be treated like that in front of his sons.
I don't have four or five other cop cars pulling up before they pull me out the car, you know. And they're probably saying to me, show us your identification. And the other, they're saying, you know, show us your hands.
I do think it is a statement to the U.S., taken by citizens of the U.S., understanding that it's my right to protest the actions of my government. And that's why the U.S. is supposed to be a great country, because you can do that.
Now that I'm aware about the story behind the national anthem, I have a change of view of my feelings about them kneeling. You know, I never realized Francis Scott Key was a slave owner. They nitpicked the parts they wanted in it so they wouldn't defend anybody later on in years.
Those who have decided to take a knee or hold up their fist during the national anthem, in my opinion, is showing disrespect for those who've served this country or who are currently serving this country.
Because it's, you know, the land of the free, home of the brave, but it's the land of the free because of the brave.
I understand about the movement going on about Colin Kaepernick. The problem I have with it is that there's other ways you can argue the point, you know, but not disrespecting the country.
Fortunately, it's those of us who've served this country and under those colors that have given the people the right to do that.
Do I think this is disrespectful to people that served in the military? No. Again, I'm a United States Air Force veteran, and this would not at all cause me a problem because of the fact that people are not acknowledging or accepting the responsibility of standing during the national anthem.
I don't feel this is disrespectful. Like the flag, I mean, the only disrespectful to the flag I see is whenever you burn it.
I don't want to hear complaints, you know, bring a solution. You know, because if you're just complaining, then you're just making noise. At least bring something to the table to work with.
Put homage and respect back into the neighborhoods by having community block grants and community block dollars put back in place in the inner cities. Too much attention has been put into building the downtowns of major cities. I think in order for us to bring more recognition to the issue that Colin Kaepernick is trying to manifest, pretty much deals with the fact that somebody of that status had to step up and do something more than just protest.
I know radio probably ain't gonna play this.
That piece was produced by Lewis A. Scott from San Quentin Radio. It's a collaboration between incarcerated men and the staff at KALW News. Stories are approved for broadcast by Lieutenant Sam Robinson.
Home of the brave and free.
It's America.
Free just to murder me.
Land of the handgun.
Land of the beautiful.
Home of the shotgun.
Cursed by the hate we throw.
You're dead if you ain't got
Is
one.
This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Colin Kaepernick's protests and those of other athletes following his lead have focused on police misconduct. Several incidents have fueled concerns around the country, including many right here in the Bay Area. That's what drew filmmaker Pete Nix to make his documentary movie The Force, which is out in Bay Area theaters right now. The film is about the Oakland Police Department, an organization put under federal oversight more than a decade ago because of abuse of power issues by officers. When the film was about to be released, the department came under investigation again for a sex scandal involving a teenaged girl. But this documentary goes beyond those headlines to explore the inner workings of a police department. And it does it so well, Pete Nix was named Best Director of a U.S. documentary film this year at the Sundance Film Festival. He sat down for a conversation with KALW's Rose Aguilar, who asked him how he got such deep access to the Oakland Police Department.
Because you were there at recruiting meetings, behind the scenes when officers were talking about how they planned to respond when Black Lives Matter protests were on the streets of Oakland, when they were in various neighborhoods late at night. I mean, you got major access. How did you get that?
I think it was because this was a police department, when we approached them, that was a model for reform in the nation, and they wanted to tell their story. That's my gut feeling about it. I mean, there's a couple of reasons. That's one. They felt that their story hadn't been fully told. There was a degree of transparency. They were one of the first departments in the country to implement department-wide body-worn camera, and that became a model. That is becoming a model for the country. So we were surprised by the amount of transparency. I wouldn't say eagerness to let us in. You know, there was not across the board. We were not welcomed across the board at the department, but there was a decision among city officials within the department to allow us in to try to tell the story of what they were doing, which was making a lot of progress.
When I was watching the film, I was wondering, these officers, these chiefs, know that you're there filming. So are they saying what they want the public to hear, knowing that you're there? Are they being honest, or are they just playing for the camera?
Of course. I mean, we've all gone out on a first date, you know, or a job interview, and I think we always try to present an image of ourselves in the best possible light. And this is the art. You talk to, you know, still photographers talk about this, the moment of truth. And oftentimes you have to be patient, you have to wait for that truth and that authenticity to be revealed. And what I always say is that, you know, crisis tends to reveal truth and character. And if you stick around long enough, there will be a crisis and truth will be revealed. And that is sort of the approach that we take to all of our subjects. We spent 3 years roughly embedded institutionally within this police department. And eventually things happened that were a tremendous challenge and revealed much about that department and that we tried to tease out in the film.
Initially, you have said that when you decided to make this film, you wanted to find out who becomes a cop and why. And you filmed some of these new recruit trainings. And I think what struck me is when we do shows about police, we've had a number of police officers on from Officers for Justice with the SFPD. These are mostly officers of color. But you don't really hear, especially young police, speak in the media at all. And what really struck me about some of these new recruit meetings were just how young these mostly guys were. There were a couple young women, and I'd like to ask you about the young women. Mm-hmm. But is it safe to say it's about 70% of color among the new recruits? That's what it looked like to me just in the rooms that you filmed.
I wish I had that actual statistic.
It was high.
It was surprisingly high to us, and I think there's been a concerted effort to increase the diversity in police departments. That's been driven to some degree by the national conversation, Black Lives Matter, what have you, however you want to describe it. There's been a lot of pressure. Similar to in Hollywood, the Oscars So White movement has resulted in new voices coming forward in Hollywood. You know, you think about Barry Jenkins, you know, Moonlight, Ryan Coogler's work, so many films as Ava DuVernay, so many films in development. I believe personally it came from that pressure, and the story is very similar. In policing, there's been a tremendous amount of, there's a lot of criticism, you know, on both sides. People criticize the police, some people criticize the activism around this issue for whitewashing and not getting into the complexity of this issue, i.e. not all cops are evil and up to no good. There is a lot of progressive, policies that are in place. There's a lot of good cops trying to do the right thing. And at the academy level, we were very interested in trying to understand what does that look like, because a lot of people believe that reform, that the academy is a significant part of that reform process, that if we bring in the right kind of officers with the right mentality. And we saw a whole range of personalities within that department, from officers who have never fired their service weapon to officers who have had numerous shootings on their record. And so, you know, is that just situational, or does that speak to sort of their decision-making process? So we really did want to understand the mentality of these young recruits, and also prior to the scandal breaking, our film was completely different. We were much mm-hmm. more digging into that question of who becomes a cop and why, and then how does the job change you mm-hmm. over time? How does then stepping out onto the street, being in the environments that they're in, facing really the worst of this community, failures of the education system, failures of the healthcare system, generational poverty, officers are seeing the results of that up front, face-to-face, every day, mental illness. These realities the general public doesn't have.
What really struck you about being in the room with new recruits and why these young people decide to join, especially at this time?
Yeah, and you know, a lot of what we found surprising is a lot of people come in with an idealism that is rooted in personal experience. One of the officers, he lost two of his brothers, you know, to gang violence, and he wanted to make a difference and become a cop. And so these are the stories that you don't tend to hear. There was a whole section of the film that got cut out of the film before the scandal happened, where the mayor spent her first day with the OPD, and she went around the room asking every recruit, why did you want to become a cop here in Oakland? And the responses were really profound to us and spoke to a narrative that the general public tends not, they just don't have access to.
And in one of the new recruits class, it looked like there were only two young women in there. Can you give us a sense of these young women, why they decide to join, and what it's like for them to be in a room of new recruits with 90% of the room is male?
It's fascinating. I mean, I was much more keyed in on, you know, being an African-American, you know, film storyteller, mm-hmm. like that dynamic of being a black cop. Like, how do you reconcile your identity as a black man with being a cop, with the conversation revolving so deeply around race and the type of code switching that must have to happen, or sort of holding, biting your tongue, or sitting on the sidelines when you want to say something and you can't, you know. And I think for women, it's maybe even more present, that dynamic of feeling sort of isolated in a police department whose culture has been so historically defined by a macho-ness, or, you know, and I think the mayor described it as a toxic macho culture. And it does raise the question, wow, what if we had more women running our police departments? Now we do have a woman running the police department. We have a mayor. We have a city leadership that's predominantly run by women. So it was something that we would have loved to have delved into in a much deeper way, and we were sort of delving into that questions of that more before the scandal happened, which that scandal really forced us. I mean, it happened at the end. We were almost done with the film.
Mm-hmm.
We were getting ready to take it to Sundance when this thing happened. We had discussions of not even including it in the film, and we determined that was impossible because it was an international story.
That's documentary filmmaker Pete Nix talking about his latest movie, The Force, which is out in Bay Area theaters. We heard an excerpt from a conversation with KALW's Rose Aguilar on Your Call. You can find the extended version at KALW.org.